Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Ellen Weir Casey. She is the mother of one of the world's first IVF babies. Her memoir, Unstoppable, Forging the Path to Motherhood in the Early Days of IVF, is a bestseller and Zibby Book Award finalist. She speaks nationally and internationally about her unique experience in the earliest days of assisted reproductive technology. Ellen has graduate and undergraduate degrees from Colorado College, and she studied memoir writing at the Aspen Institute Summer Words Program. Ellen lives in the shadow of Pikes Peak in the foothills of Colorado Springs. Welcome, Ellen.
Good afternoon, Ronit.
I'm so happy to have you on this show and excited that you have time to talk with me about your memoir. So can you share a bit about Unstoppable?
I can. Well, I am a pioneer. I am the mother of one of the world's first babies conceived using the then experimental technique called IVF. It is IVF, but then my daughter was proclaimed as Colorado's first test tube baby on headlines around the United States and the world. And very flustered news anchors on the evening news would say, oh my God, a miracle baby has been born in the state of Colorado.
Wow.
So what I have done is write the memoir of my experience 4 long years in the earliest days of assisted reproductive technology. I was so lucky to live in an incredibly exciting, rapidly unfolding day when everything new was just at its peak. People were trying all these amazing experimental techniques, such as microsurgery, laser surgery, ending with in vitro fertilization. Mm-hmm. And I did it all, Ronit. I traveled to Vancouver, Canada, to be among the first patients for a doctor who is now known as the father of microsurgery. I traveled to Hartford, Connecticut, to have surgery by a doctor who is now known as the father of laser surgery. And my final stop was Houston, Texas, where I was accepted into the second IVF program approved to operate in the United States. And at that time, it was called an experimental program. Mm-hmm. So I've written my book about this, and it was a crazy time, really. I didn't know how fortunate I was to be living then. Also, it was a time before the internet, so I had to do all of my research in the library basement of the public library in Colorado Springs, where I live, going over microfiche articles in medical journals and looking for the words fallopian tubes. My fallopian tubes were blocked because an unscrupulous doctor had given me an unapproved IUD when I was 23 that caused a terrible infection, scarred my uterus, my fallopian tubes, my ovaries, and my intestines. So that is what I had to do, find someone who was opening fallopian tubes. And the first doctor I found was only two in the world doing this kind of surgery, one in Vancouver and one in London. So I opted for London, but my husband decided it was better to go to Canada.
Yeah, and it's like I remember, so I was in elementary school in the 80s, and I do remember learning of news headlines and hearing, you know, the way kids talk about things, test tube babies, like, you know, you just heard about it. And I remember vaguely maybe some nightly news shows with interviews with women who've done it and doctors. And of course, I can't even locate like which one I saw, but I remember at the time thinking that it seemed so modern and so in the future and hard to even fathom. But now we've come so far from there. So what is it like for you to be living in this era where there's even more unusual and new developments in science and things that we couldn't have even conceived of, but having been a pioneer on the end of a pioneer of it?
I am delighted that young women have opportunities today. They have options. There mm-hmm. are remarkable techniques, scientific and medical, that can help them create the family that they so desperately want. And I am proud to have been a pioneer patient. Mm-hmm. In England, they now call me medical celebrity. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Because of writing this memoir, I've gotten incredible international attention. They are very interested in my story, especially in England. And of all things, because of writing my book, I was invited to go to the home of IVF in Cambridge, just north of Cambridge, England, where I had professional photos taken of me with Louise Brown, who was the world's first test tube baby. And she and I were the featured guests at an event.
Wow. So was it worrisome for you when you were carrying the baby, when everything looked like it was going to turn out fine? Were there people who didn't know about the process very well who were concerned for you? Were you and your husband ever worried that something might be different about your baby?
No, I never, ever was worried for a minute. I knew that all I needed to do was get the sperm to meet an egg and have it put back into my body, and I would have a healthy baby. Mm-hmm. However, I will tell you that at that time, I could tell that the doctors were concerned. My doctor was in Houston, Texas, and of course, we lived in Colorado. So I had a lot of doctor appointments, and what they did was they had my obstetrician measure the head of the mm-hmm. fetus using ultrasound. And I realized, of course, they were trying to see if she would be born normal because mm-hmm. they did not know. These babies were experimental and they did not know if they would be all right. I never had one doubt that she would be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no one knew what IVF was. You know, that acronym hadn't even been coined yet. But I realized it was my responsibility to educate the public and to let other women know they had a chance now mm-hmm. to have a baby. No one knew that this clinic, this program at the University of Texas was operating, and we had only had one other baby born in the United States, Elizabeth Carr, who was born mm-hmm. in Virginia in 1981. So people didn't know what it was, and I knew it was my job to tell. Mm-hmm. But no one had heard, you know, no one knew what it was. They'd heard that term, test tube baby. For instance, I was standing in line at the grocery store one day, 9 months pregnant, mm-hmm. and a woman said, "Oh, is this your first baby?" "Yes," I said, "it is. And this is a test tube baby."
Well, oh my gosh.
She said, "Oh, where is the baby growing?"
Oh, goodness. I mean, yeah, but like, this is funny because you were really unafraid and proud.
I was proud, and I felt I had been put in this situation for a reason, and that is that I felt it was so important to help mm-hmm. other women know that they had a chance to have a child, because people were at the end of the line if they had blocked fallopian tubes, and I wanted to let them know that they had a chance. Also, I wanted to protect my baby Elizabeth from being viewed as an oddity. Mm-hmm. What I wanted, it was my goal, that by the time she started kindergarten, everyone would know what in vitro fertilization was, how it worked, and that she was a perfectly normal, so loved and desperately wanted child.
Mm-hmm. When did you know or realize that you wanted to write this book?
I was at a party. I was at a party for a two-year-old's birthday, and I was talking with a group of young dads in their late 20s, early 30s. A woman walked in by the group and said to the boys, "Ellen is the mother of Colorado's first test tube baby." And she walked away, and these young men said, "Oh my God, how did you do that before the internet?"
Oh, yeah.
And they kept peppering me with questions, and I was thrilled and so surprised. And they kept saying, "But how did you even find who was doing this brand new technology?" After that party, I got in my car, drove the 3 minutes home, and by the time I was home, I had decided I was going to write a memoir because I was a part of medical history and women's history, and this story needed to be told.
Mm-hmm. And had you written a lot before then?
I had written one other book. It's a curriculum. I interviewed 7 Nobel Peace Prize winners about their childhoods and wrote a curriculum called Peace in Our Hands, which introduces little children starting in kindergarten to another little child, like this, the Dalai Lama. But what I did was talk to each Nobel Prize winner about something they did that was naughty as a child. So then the children to whom this program is being taught feel an affinity to this other little kid. So I had written that, but it was, of course, completely different than writing a memoir. So as I had never had a class in memoir writing, I thought, okay. So I got home from that party, sat down at my computer looking for memoir writing classes in Colorado, and I found the Aspen Institute. The famous Aspen Institute has a summer words program, and I was accepted into the class of 10 students in memoir. So I went up there for a week, and it was fabulous. Came home. I waited 4 months before I started writing. I took that 4 months to write down words, individual words like avuncular, and specific descriptions of hospitals, of operating rooms, of doctors' offices, chairs and ceilings, all kinds of words that I could use in phrases and descriptions in my book. And in January, I sat after, well, 6 months later, I sat down and wrote my memoir.
Mm. And what aspects of writing Unstoppable challenged you in particular, or what parts did you enjoy a lot digging into and really spending time with?
Oh, do you know, it was one of the most fun things I have ever done in my life was to write this book. I loved it. Challenging situations were the people, writing about people who are alive. And there were some people in our lives who were not particularly pleased that we had had a baby conceived this way. And I was quite delighted to sit down and write a chapter specifically about that. When I looked at that chapter later, I thought, you know, take the high road. And I took that chapter and threw it away. So I did these people a favor by not mentioning them in the book at all. That was what was challenging. In writing about the doctors, I wanted to be so careful and write everything correctly. That was a challenge because when the book was ready to be published, I had to send the chapters to each of these famous doctors, have them read the chapter about themselves, which is nerve-wracking.
Yes, yes.
For approval. And luckily, my memory is so good. I'm a believer that emotional memory is much more clear than factual memory. But I had kept every calendar that I have since, God knows, since I got out of college, really. So I had the dates I could confirm. I could confirm what day I visited this physician in this place. And I had files. I had kept copious files of everything, of the paper plane tickets, of handwritten notes about how to get into the office for the first visit with the IVF doctor. So I was really able to write everything.
Yeah.
I could confirm what my emotional memory had said to me was what had happened.
Do you have any suggestions or advice for memoirists who might need to reach out to people that worked with them or treated them to get confirmation of what happened and the different procedures? Was there something that you discovered in reaching out to these physicians that worked really well for you? Were they amenable to it, or were they hard to pin down or to get to return the material you needed?
Actually, they were thrilled.
Oh,
everyone wants to read about themselves,
right? Right, yeah.
I'll tell you, this is one of the very best parts of writing this book, was reconnecting with the people who had saved my life by working together and helping me have a child. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to find, for instance, the doctor in Vancouver is now in his 80s, and he lives half-time in Paris. And I could not find him because he's retired from the hospital in Vancouver, and they could not share his contact information. So you may tell your writers who listen to you, they need to then find. What I did was I went to the publisher of the books he had written, sent them a letter saying who I was, and then they contacted him, and then he contacted me. Mm-hmm. But also, I would say, do your homework. Make sure you have every detail correct. And be prepared. The doctor or to whomever you are sending this story about him may not agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Did you end up changing the material based on their reaction?
No. It's a great story. So Dr. Gomel, who is charming, and in my memoir, as I said, it's difficult to write about living people. And I put in there that he, in his cultured diction, said blah, blah, blah. Well, what I meant to let you know was that he was born in Iran, practiced in British Columbia, and now lives in Paris and has a French patois. So I could hardly ever understand a word this lovely man said to me. He called me from Paris, and we had a wonderful conversation. And he went, "Ellen, you have made a mistake." And I went, "Oh, no, what?" "Ellen, there is no way. This was a five-hour surgery. I would never have done that." "Oh," I said, "well, you know, Dr. Gomel, I believe I have your typewritten copy of your dictated surgical notes." And he was thrilled. And he goes, "Really?" And I said, "Let me look." And he said, "If indeed you have those, mail them to me." And I said, "I will, but it's my memory that it was a five-hour surgery." Well, it was a five-hour surgery. But he was thrilled in this day of everything being in the cloud.
Sure.
He was thrilled to see a hard copy of his surgical notes.
Yeah, and also it does kind of, it kind of speaks to our memories matter the most. I mean, it's weird because you want to verify what you're saying, especially if it's based in fact and it's based in something that is, something that was recorded and that involves another person. But also, you really felt that it was a five-hour surgery. And so had you, for example, not gotten confirmation, that's an opportunity in a memoir. And this is just general advice, not to you, to say it felt like a five-hour surgery. I was almost positive it was a five-hour surgery, and I'll never know for sure if it was or not, but that's what I think it was, right? Like, you can always, if you don't have the statistics that you need, you can always do that in your writing. But how lovely lovely. What a treat to be able to connect with these doctors and also in a way to celebrate the life that you and your daughter and your husband were able to have together because of them.
Oh, you know, that has been a true gift to me. It just speaking to these people. And I had one of the doctors was in Colorado Springs last summer, and we had lunch together. And I looked at him and said, Dr. Smith, to be able to look you in the eye and thank you for changing my life forever for the better. Mm-hmm. It's so wonderful. And, you know, both of us had tears in our eyes. His wife was sitting there blotting her eyes. It was so powerful to be able to thank each one of these surgeons who actually each one of them did something that helped down the road for me to have my baby.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've created sections within the book for history and context about different areas of reproductive health and just surgery. There's one on IVF, the pill, religion, marriage, and infertility treatments, more, you know, lots of them throughout the book. And I wonder how you landed on this structure and how you knew which areas earned a section unto themselves.
Good question. Thank you for noticing that. I got the idea from reading The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. In that book, they put factual chapters, full chapters, after telling the story of Henrietta. Then there would and her experience. Then there would be another experiential story and then the facts. I didn't want to put a whole chapter, as I did not want to stop the narrative, but after some of these, it was important to let the reader understand the chronology, for instance, in the one you mentioned, a birth control between 1960 and 1974. I don't think women today realize that the government had such a say in our reproductive health. The Supreme Court ruled that birth control was legal for all U.S. citizens, married or not, in 1972.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing to remember that, to see that. I just never even thought about that anymore.
No, I know. And that is why I am a advocate for women's health and for women paying attention to what is happening in our country legislatively. Women need to be in touch with legislators and tell them what they need and how legislation can help them if indeed they feel legislation needs to be involved in our bodies at all.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that struck me, I mean, so much of this did because it reminded me how far we've come, but also worries me about the different rights that could be taken away and how much the government has been involved in our reproductive freedom for so long. You write in one particular point, quote, years later, I was 24 years old when I talked to a gynecologist in his office in Colorado Springs. I was so embarrassed to have to discuss birth control with a man that I almost canceled the appointment. My face felt moist. I tried to mask my self-consciousness by presenting myself as an intellectual adult. I even tried to lower my voice to sound more grown up. And I too, Ellen, used to be so mortified about things like this, going to the gynecologist, buying tampons, you name it, walking out of the store almost ashamed that I might have something for my period with me in a bag and needing to have a double bag to protect the label from showing through, things like that. So has your approach to your body or your womanhood and your femininity and what you biologically need, has that changed at all over the years?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I felt the same way you did. I mean, I would throw my coat over the tampons in the grocery cart. Mm-hmm. So I know just what you're saying. We have such a strange shame when we shouldn't. This is natural. This is how our bodies work. But we do. And I think a lot of it is, you know, post-Victorian mores. Mm-hmm. Infertility was never discussed when I was growing up or when I was trying to have a child. It wasn't even a word that anyone used, nor did they use the word fertility. I never discussed it with my friends. And the friends that I did know who adopted children, I was so happy for them, but I never would have said, you know, why mm-hmm. did you adopt? We would never have discussed that. Right. So there was a great cloud of shame and silence around anything to do with sexuality or childbirth.
Mm-hmm. I notice with my children and their friends who are teenagers right now that they don't seem to have that kind of self-consciousness, that public worry of, you know, going and shopping for what they need in the drugstore or wearing the clothes that they want to wear. Or and in fact, you know, on a side note, you know, if some man notices their body in public, for example, I used to be just completely nervous about it and scandalized and worried and wanted to protect them. And I've heard from them that it's really that man's problem, that the kid I'm talking about can wear whatever they want. It's the adult's problem if they have an issue. Like, it's not something that the kid needs to worry about. Yeah. Which I just was like, I don't consider myself a conservative person, but it was a revelation to me.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
Oh, you're doing something right. Your generation.
I don't know.
Oh, you are. Your generation has such an open dialogue with your children. And I certainly did not have one when I was growing up. So I'm so pleased to hear that. Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, I pulled this chart from page 10 of your book, and then you're going to read a section of your book for us. But it's this chart, Early Birth Control from 1960 to 1974. And oh my goodness, this just surprised me. I knew that in 1960, which you have here, the birth control pill was approved by the FDA. I knew that. But in 1965, this one blew me away. The Supreme Court ruled in 1965 that married couples had the right to use birth control. And that nullified the Comstock Act of 1873, which prohibited distribution of an advertising about birth control. And then in 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that birth control was legal for all U.S. citizens, married or not. I mean, it's so funny to me, but of course, it's not that long ago.
It's not that long ago, and it's shocking, isn't it?
Yes.
It's how quickly things have moved. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book was to tell women exactly that. I think that women need to know the stories of the women who went before them, who opened the doors that they can mm-hmm. now walk through, like going into an in vitro program when mm-hmm. no one knew such a thing existed. Women who stood up and said, no, we need to be able to have birth control. And of course, it was a man's world in 1980s when I was trying to have a child, and there were only male obstetricians mm-hmm. and gynecologists. I mm-hmm. never had the option to go to a woman. So there were plenty of things that I never, ever would have told a male mm-hmm. doctor or asked.
Yes. Yes, and even think now with the young women who are freezing their eggs for later conception so that they have the choice. These are conversations that, along with maybe financial stability and saving money and finding out, you know, that you have a good health plan, freezing your eggs, these things are kind of in the conversation.
They are. It's wonderful. It's mm-hmm. wonderful. And if you Google infertility or IVF, hundreds of millions of sites come up, hundreds of millions.
Yes. Yes. And so it's funny how far we've come. And then, of course, some things feel really regressive, like the issues we're having with abortion rights in this country. So it's just, it's always, I just feel like we're always on the precipice. So, okay, I would love you to introduce the section that you're going to read and then go ahead and read it.
Okay. This is the last chapter. This is the beginning of the last chapter in my book. And it is, the scene is the morning I was going to have my 5 fertilized embryos transferred back into my body, where the prayer was they would burrow into the lining of the uterus and become viable embryos and end up having a viable baby. So here I am. The next morning, I lay very still in a quiet, gently darkened surgery room. It was now 2 days after my 5 eggs had been harvested from my ovaries and fertilized. Sylvia, the nurse, had handed me a Valium tablet in a pleated paper cup to swallow with water sometime within the last hour. I wasn't sure now exactly how long ago, as the effects of the sedative were filling me with a soft drowsiness and feeling of well-being. Sylvia had sat sideways on a chair in the empty waiting room and watched as I popped the pill into my mouth and gulped down the glass of water she placed on a table next to me. She explained in her quiet southern manner how the embryos would soon be transferred into my body by Dr. Quigley. He would thread a tiny pipette through my cervix and push the embryo up into my uterus. I pictured the plastic toy syringe I had in my little doctor kit as a child. I would fill it with water by pulling out the plunger and then squirt all of the water back out through the end. The Valium would make my mind and body calm and relaxed, Sylvia continued. The in vitro doctors had a new theory that quieting the body with a sedative would help the uterus not reject the embryos. Following the very simple embryo transfer in a few minutes, I would stay in the hospital all this day and through the night, resting. Then what? I asked. I will be terrified to stand up in the morning for fear the embryos will fall back out. They won't fall out, Sylvia smiled patiently. Don't you think I should stay lying down for more than 24 hours? It just seems like a risk. I will be afraid to go to the bathroom. I think I should stay in bed for a few more days just to be sure. Well, Ellen, the girls who are pregnant right now only stayed in bed for 24 hours. I noticed the slightest spark in Sylvia's eyes as she spoke. Oh, my God, this program has achieved a pregnancy, I thought. At least 2 pregnancies, as she said, girls. Oh, my God, it is true. My hands began to tingle, and I couldn't manage to find any words to respond. I knew that this extraordinary information had been carefully saved, only to be imparted today. All week I had been noticing and analyzing how small bits of information were parceled out to me. It seemed to be another component of Dr. Quigley's plan to care for the psychological state of the mother going through in vitro. The mother. There were mothers. This was staggering, game-changing news. Learning it now, on the very morning I was going to have our 5 live embryos transferred back into my body, filled me with overjoyed confidence. My body could have floated away like a helium balloon. I was so euphoric. No wonder they gave me Valium, I joked to myself. An intense physical need to have my embryos back inside of me where they belonged and where I could protect them surged through me smoothly as I began to relax into the tranquilizer. I lay under a warmed blanket on the narrow operating room table, my mind wafting softly like a feather through a light blue haze in the dimly lit room, remembering. I remembered all of it. The 4 years of heartbreaking loss and brutal pain that had brought me to this room had certainly taken its toll. Every gasping sob, every tear, every scar, every hour spent poring through medical journals in the library, every second spent in emergency rooms and recovery rooms, every recurring thought of guilt, every single second of anguish would be worth it if today's final sweet moments of in vitro fertilization led to our success.
Thank you. I'm struck by the guilt that surrounds so much of your story, and not in a way that I don't mean to say that I'm surprised by it, because I know it's kind of integral to our experience. Yeah. But I wonder about your thoughts about guilt and reproduction and the body stories of so many women, you know, so many of us. And wondering if you've come to understand anything about guilt and being a woman.
Oh, yes. You know, guilt is the common thread that I hear from all the women who are having trouble having a child or maintaining a pregnancy today. It is, you know, it's been since biblical times. Infertility was seen as a punishment or a judgment by God. And in the Bible, it was the woman who was at fault, never the man, which of course we know that isn't true. But it's just so common, because a woman feels like, this is my natural right. It's my basic ability to be able to become pregnant and have a baby of our own. And when that doesn't happen, women turn inward with anxiety and guilt and shame. And it's so sad, but it is there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women, I hear them say things like, oh God, could it have been that one glass of wine I had before I even knew I was pregnant that caused me to have a miscarriage? The women always think, what was it I did? Because once you have a pregnancy, you want to maintain that pregnancy no matter what. And it is so hard to accept the fact that it was not caused by you. And there's a quote from The Power of Positive Thinking that says, there is a curious quirk in the human mind whereby sometimes an individual will not forgive himself. And that was me, because I knew what I had done. I was aware that I had caused my tubal blockage by using an experimental IUD when I was 23 years old. And I never could get over the fact that it was my fault, that the thing I wanted most in the world, to be a mother, I had ruined my chances.
Where do you stand on that now?
Well, it's interesting, because from the viewpoint I have now, I think, but if I hadn't had this tragedy happen to me where I had two ectopic pregnancies and a miscarriage and so many devastating losses because of that IUD, if I hadn't been through that, I maybe would have a baby, but I wouldn't have this wonderful Elizabeth Casey. I would not have been on the trajectory I've been on, especially since writing this book, where I have been able to help so many women, so many families. And I have been, you know, asked to come to Cambridge University and to write a blurb for one of their books. And the things that have happened to me because of what I did have been pretty wonderful. Was it worth it? Yes, I it was, because it all had a happy ending.
Yeah, and I think about the young you choosing to do that, to trust a doctor who, why wouldn't you trust a doctor, right?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Now we know we need to be a little more aware of all these things, but you were so young and you were trying not to get pregnant too soon, and they put this device in you that caused a lot of damage. And reading that, I felt so bad for you, because you didn't have the education to know that this wasn't going to be a good idea. You had no idea that what you were trying to do proactively was going to end up being bad for your body, and it was not on your hands. Like, it was not in your hands. It was the doctor. Right. And so,
yes.
I just wanted to see where you were on that, because I felt for you in the book when you blamed yourself for that. When I think women, we blame so much on ourselves.
We do. And then we also get into that thing of, oh my God, I never wanted anyone to know that I was using birth control. I just didn't want anyone to know that.
Especially back then.
There's
such a stigma.
Oh, in the 70s. And, you know, I never told my mother that is what caused the scarring that necessitated me having all these multiple surgeries.
So she never knew?
No.
Interesting.
She never asked. No, because you didn't discuss it.
Yes, and that's why it's even more revolutionary, right, that you wrote this book. Like, to start from, you know, if you look at where you began this whole reproductive journey, being a young woman, to where you are now, having written a book about it and being an advocate and sort of an educator about it. It's just, it's incredible.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yeah. And how is your daughter and what does she think of your book?
Oh, she's wonderful. You know, her first television interview was when she was 2 days old. I had been in touch with the newspaper and I let them know when she was born, because right then I knew I had to share this information with couples and to make sure that everyone knew that this baby was not the shape of a test tube, that she hadn't been born in a lab, but that she was perfectly normal and healthy and happy and loved. Mm-hmm. So it's been her life. So to her, it's not such a big deal that the TV cameras are all back in my house interviewing me because of this book, or that I'm being invited to go speak at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. She's wonderful. She's absolutely wonderful. She went to Northwestern University, and she's happily married with a four-year-old and a newborn.
Oh, congratulations. Do you feel like there were some memoirs that were especially helpful to you when you were studying at the Aspen School, or as you were gathering the resources to write your own?
You know, I love, in Aspen, I was in a class of 10, and we had each written a manuscript. We'd each written 10 pages, and each day we went through two writers' manuscripts and tore them apart. I've never been in a class like that, but I understand that's how it works. I was horrified. But their writing was astounding. I learned more from reading those 10 pages of 100 pages than I have anywhere else. They were wonderful writers, but I love memoir, and I love Glass Castle. I love Wild Game by Adrian mm-hmm. Brodeur, who is the executive director of the Aspen Institute. And you know, I love Educated, of course. Mm-hmm. And I especially love Madman in the Woods by mm-hmm. Jamie Gearing, who you interviewed.
Yes, I love Jamie. She was one of my first guests, too. Yeah.
I met Jamie at Zibby Owens' house in New York City a year ago, right now.
Oh, wow. How wonderful that must have been.
But that book is an excellent memoir mm-hmm. and researched. One of the most interesting parts for me of writing this was the research I did. Mm-hmm. I learned so much more than I knew about the varying techniques, about things like the history of birth control. I've learned so much since I began to write this book. Here's one thing I learned in England, and I was shocked. Dr. Steptoe and Dr. Edwards, who are the doctors who facilitated the birth of Louise Brown in 1978, the first test tube baby in the world, before she was born, 282 women had tried.
Oh, wow.
They had tried IVF. And those are the women that I wish I could meet and thank. But, mm-hmm. you know, most of them are probably not even alive anymore. Mm-hmm. Isn't that things I never knew?
Yes. Do you have advice for writers working on their memoirs?
Oh, goodness, so much. I would say write everything you remember, everything you feel, and then put it away. After I'd written the completed manuscript, I put it away for 6 months. And then I took it out again, and it was, oh, okay, I need to fix this, I need to flesh out this, I am definitely removing that. Mm-hmm. I think really, because you pour so much emotion, because this is your story, this is your life, and that was the best thing I think I did.
It is so magical giving something time to just settle and let yourself take a break from it, because then you become almost the most powerful editor
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And where can people find you, Ellen? If they want to learn more about you and your book and get your book, where's the best place?
You can get it on Amazon. You can order it from any independent bookstore. It's a bestseller on Amazon in fertility and infertility and pregnancy, which is great. You can find me on Instagram, and it's at Ellen, E-L-L-E-N, 2956.
Thank you. I'll put all of that in the show notes so people can click on those links. And thank you for sharing your story, and congratulations on being a bestseller in those categories. That's pretty wonderful. And I'm so happy that you were able to share your story in your memoir and also spend time with me to talk about the process of writing it. It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure for me, too. And I am so impressed by the fact that you knew my memoir so well that you could really create an interesting discussion. So bravo to you.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RonitPlank. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.